metrics and the strategy and the social communications. It's entirely appropriate that Dan gives this talk because he is in fact one of the tools you can use. We know the nicest possible. That's a great introduction.
Wow, that's like that's like the best intro. Thank you. Thanks a lot, Paul.
No worries. Thanks
to me for the opportunity to speak today. It might have been a slow day at Ori to organise the July Tuesdays with Ori, but we'd planned to give this talk a while ago, so it's better as good a time as any. Thanks all of you for coming, and it is a discussion. So if you have any questions or if you have a comment, just shout out. It's actually quite a nice small group in terms of size, and I have a diverse background. I apologise, I got a cold like two days ago, and I've just taken some cold and flu tablets. So if I pass out, yeah, I have an excuse. The outline for the discussion today, I'll present some slides around following this broad outline, and that is, what is authorship? I mean, that makes sense that we cover that throughout the whole talk, but we'll talk about that at the start. And what does it look like? And Paul mentioned my background, and I've got a small background in metrics, but I like data. I like looking at data. And so we've got some data about authorship and what it looks like. The title of the talk is slightly incorrect because it should be rules and tools. So the rules will come first, and that's probably a good place to start. Set the groundwork for that. And we'll look at what is we refer to as a complex ecosystem of rules, and it's kind of unsurprising. There are many discipline differences in how to practice authorship. And we'd like to talk to you about the creation and the evolution of the university's authorship policy, which is like our prototypic new way of talking about research policies. We're trying to make sensible policies and procedures for how research is conducted at the university and how it's conducted well and responsibly. And we'll talk about that. I mean, that makes sense. We'll talk about that. And then we'll talk about some tools. And thanks very much, Paul. I didn't put myself in the slide. I was egotistical enough to be here. But we'll talk about really implementing that policy, the policy that we've created, and other ways that people have essentially created to so that making the conversation easier. And you get to talking about authorship. It can be quite difficult. It'd be weird if I didn't have an authorship listing for this talk. I didn't acknowledge people. It would just be completely weird and wrong. Co-author is Paul Taylor. Thanks very much, Paul, for your significant contribution to the work. The people on the left there are diverse representatives from the university who were a part of the authorship policy working group. You can't really get anything done at the university without a working group. It's just how universities work. But anyway, there's a mixture of really experienced professors, student researchers, research managers like Paul and I, who really spent a lot of time and effort on trying to make something that sounded sensible for the university in terms of guidance and instruction. I'd really like to acknowledge and thank Simon Porter and Melissa Macon and Jasmine Zen. I don't know if I pronounce this right, Zenkic. I apologise to Jasmine. But they've done some excellent work on data and metrics around authorship. Really, really intriguing, and I'll show you some of that. And I'd like to acknowledge also Kim Gilliland, Research Integrity Project Officer at Ori. She's been immensely helpful in applying her legal background in trying to decipher what research policies say and mean. I have a competing interest statement. I am from Ori. If you please remember us. If you think Orio, think Ori. Orio, Ori. You know, if you're starting to worry, please contact Ori, that kind of thing. If you're waiting for an approval to do work and it's taking too long, sorry from Ori. But please go to our website. This talk and all the other Tuesdays with Ori talks are available up there. Authorship. Well, responsible practice in it is very important because authorship is linked to, like it or not, money in many regards for the institution and for people. Really, fundamentally, it rewards contribution and assigns responsibility for research. Generally, it's easy to talk about the rewards and the credit, but it also there's a deep responsibility being an author. In theory, it is easy, and it's been going on for a long, long time. As it was mentioned before, fundamentally, an author of a research output, such as a journal article, a book, or a performance, is someone who's made a significant intellectual or scholarly contribution to the research described and is accountable for the integrity of his or her contribution. That's the base level. That's what it means. So that's pretty straightforward. In practice, however, authorship can be complex, and it's sometimes affected by opposing conventions. We see that in some interdisciplinary research in different cultures. Conflicts of interests where people are very close friends with other people. Sometimes they're married. Sometimes difficult. And sometimes just plain old misunderstandings. So sometimes authorship feels a little bit like this gift, where, you know, you have a set of co-authors and you wonder why you're not on it. And you maybe some of them outside of the pool are wondering why they're on it. And that happens as well. It's quite funny. It gets funnier every time. I try to incorporate it in every talk. So what's the context? What's the environment? So we'll just look at some publication data about research outputs, how the university communicates research, and some authorship data in it. As you can see here, generally, the research outputs at the University of Melbourne are increasing over time. This is actually quite outdated now, but if you look at journal articles, if you look at book chapters and books, book chapters particularly are increasing over time. Books take a lot longer to produce in humanities, arts, social sciences. But journal articles are definitely increasing over time. Creative and performing arts are a bit more variable. Disciplines communicate research by a diverse array of research output types. So looking at this, it's quite interesting. These are various departments from across the university, and these are the colours show you different ways that they communicate research. In the top left is the Department of Chemistry, and they predominantly communicate the research just using journal articles in the green. And biomedical and science disciplines cluster around that top left area. In the middle here, the bottom here, is engineering, and engineering uses different forms in addition to journal articles. And in the far right are the creative research outputs, so the departments in the VCA and music. And so there's quite a large diversity across the university. I try to do a faux systems biology clustering. This has very little merit in the clustering except just by eye, but it's good enough. And generally, you can see that the outputs are increasing over time, but there's a caveat with reporting on that. Authorship practices, we found, and conventions, are similarly diverse to that picture. So how research is communicated is diverse, and so are authorship practices. But here are some... We'll start with some generalities first. As has been noticed since the 80s, the average number of authors on a journal article in the sciences, in technology, and medicine is increasing. At the University of Melbourne, with these data here, the average number of authors on a journal article from faculties from such as medicine and science is over 8. It is increasing for the other disciplines that are clustered around what's called HAS, the Humanities, Arts, Social Sciences. So on average, there's just over 2. The raw average is 53 number of authors, and that's because of genomics and astronomy. Some of those disciplines have large number of authors, and that blows out the average. If you look at faculties, there is variation within faculties, and generally the average number of authors are increasing. Science is off the charts. Yeah, that's a good thing in a university obsessed with metrics. And we can see this over time, and we can see this as a scale of the research industry that the University of Melbourne is. On the bottom here, this is the number of authors listed on a journal article, and the shaded series across that are the years. And over there is showing also the number of journal articles. And as you can see, for each category of number of authors, there's a sharp angle, there's a sharp increase. suggesting there's more paper, there's more publications, there's more journal articles, and there's more authors on them over time. So this is just the environment, the context in which authorship is being done. This is because, well, research is becoming more and more collaborative, and there's more and more researchers conducting research, just a scale thing. Collaborative research is very powerful. You know, it brings together people with similar backgrounds and sometimes different backgrounds to work on and solve problems. As the numbers purely suggest, even in the humanities and arts and social sciences where there's more than one author, that means that there's discussions happening, and if you're from different backgrounds and different disciplines, the discussions just get a bit more complex. Collaboration is affected by many different factors. And so we can look at now, what does authorship look like through collaboration at the different departments? So we've got the overall context of increasing research outputs and numbers of authors. What does it actually look like? And these are data from Simon Porter's group that I mentioned earlier. And they've conducted a social network analysis of authorship, essentially, by looking at collaboration, looking at publications in this case. These two cluster maps show Faculty of Engineering and Department of Mechanical Engineering there, and a school in the Faculty of Arts. And you can see straight away that this is telling you that there are less authors interacting for research outputs in arts. And so research is done, and authorship is done differently in those two disciplines. This is not surprising. Not surprising. But we do say that it is diverse and different across different disciplines. Here are the data to show that. Sometimes missing. You can look at this in the whole faculty sense. And so we say that the faculties at the University of Melbourne are largely disciplined, based around disciplines, although science is probably an exception. You can see there here that even in the Faculty of Engineering, there are different ways of doing authorship because there are different clusters, groups of people working together. That's true in Faculty of Business and Economics as well. There are some co-author groups, collaborative research groups that author really closely knit clusters that work together and publish together. But generally, it's quite spaced out. And this is the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry, Health Sciences in 2009. These are pretty to look at, but you can actually do some analysis on these, a social network analysis. And that's what has been done for this map. And this is where you can discern different types of behaviour according to, essentially, economic theory, how people are actually behaving in the way that they're doing authorship. And they get called brokers because they broker relationships, connectedness between authors. And you can rank these people according to how many hits or interactions that they have within their network. So right now we're looking at people, I've blacked out their names, who are in the middle of coordinating different authors within the same group, so within the same research group, within the same department. These people exist. They're very good at coordinating and co-publishing with people within the department. And you can see that you would think mostly these people are established researchers, but there are a couple of, I've labelled here, an early career researcher. We class them as early career researcher in terms of their length of career. And I use the term mid-career researcher. These are people who have established this type of behaviour as early career researchers and are now doing this as mid-career researchers, I think. Itinerant brokers are people who co-author with other authors from different departments. These people are very good at collaboration. So you can see this is how their diagram, these people are represented within the network. So they interact with people across different departments. And there's an ECR, an early career researcher in the Department of Immunology doing that. Biochemistry. And then there are people called gatekeepers. And these people, if you look at the way that they're interacting with other people on the map, are allowing people from outside the department to publish with them. So they're saying yes and no to things in the authorship discussion, or perhaps in the generation of collaborations. Again, there are some ECRs here, but there are people here who are very well-established researchers, as you would probably expect. This systems analysis is interesting, and this is just a very early phase of this. It's very, very beginning of this. And trying to put a value on these things in terms of value terms of saying this is good authorship practice or this is bad authorship practice is very difficult, if it's responsible or not. So in summary, there's lots of research going on, and we're getting a feel for how authors are interacting in the large networks that exist in collaboration. But there are discipline differences, and we've actually had the data to show that. And this is not an unknown. So what are the rules for authorship? What are the baselines? What are the foundations? Really, we assume everyone does authorship well, responsibly, and that's a fair assumption to make. And as was made earlier, a comment earlier, this has been going on for a long time, so, and cultures have been built around these practices. So really we're asking, where do researchers obtain information about how to do this? The information exists within individuals, as my story highlighted earlier, when I was a PhD student, I had my own expectations about authorship practice, and that influenced other people. Communities, and what I mean by that, are more than one person interacting with each other. So they might be within a research group, they might be across departments. And they have different ways of doing things, because you become friends and you interact with people on different levels, and people contribute different things to the research. Disciplines definitely have information embedded. Often this is unwritten, the expectations about how authorship is done and who is first author and what does last author mean, who's not an author. And underneath that, there are more, I guess, formal ways of getting information about authorship, and that's from places like the university, as well as governments and publishers, which are quite influential. And if you get a smart board and you, have some artistic talent, on display, you can show this. You just show this as a discussion piece. In that, once you get more than one person from a background and a certain discipline, then there's complexity to influence authorship practice. So, individuals will have expectations about how authorship is done. Where they're from will matter. And increasingly that's becoming very, very different for us. That's good. That's a very good thing. What discipline that they're in will definitely affect, what their expectations are. The first one is medicine. The second one is supposed to be engineering. Any guesses? What was that? Yeah, that's a new one. Yeah. It's different every time almost. Was there any? Yeah. It's stem cell research or high energy physics, I don't know. Interestingly, there's a lot of information about authorship from institutions, from publishers and from the government. And for some reason, they're quite diverse. It's quite diverse. When nature says this is how authorship is done, often people will default to that because it's nature. But the NHMRC and funding bodies, we have obligations to if you receive funds from the NHMRC or the ARC, you are legally bound to follow the rules in the Australian Code, which is an interesting consideration. We thought about this in terms of ORI, in terms of the office, and we thought, what are the roles of research institutions and organisations within that ecosystem? Although academic freedom is paramount and it's an academic place, we do have a relationship with researchers as an employer and as an enroller. So we can actually mandate rules, and we have responsibilities around providing a safe working and learning environment. And if we're going to say things, they should have a basis for them, a rationale. That's why we undertake data analysis and build an evidence base around our decisions. We have responsibilities in providing education and training in authorship, as well as all aspects of responsible collective research, and really setting clear rules and expectations for behaviour, so that people, not only does it make everything easier and makes everything good in doing research, but it's also very, very clear where the boundaries are, and so where and people have done the wrong thing. There's no surprises. So up until recently, what did the university say to its researchers about authorship? It said it in this document, the Code of Conduct for Research, which we are reviewing and rewriting at the moment. If you look at that document, it's largely prescriptive. It doesn't have rationale for why it's saying things. It said some good things about authorship in that authorship requires agreement between the authors. It suggests that author order is important for some disciplines, and it gave a role for something called a corresponding author, had administrative position. It didn't recognise the range of authorship practices at the university. It was based around a 1985 International Committee of Medical Journal Editors guidelines, so that's the Vancouver Protocol. We'll talk about a little bit more in a second. Didn't say anything about how to actually do authorship well, in terms of, you would use the term good practice or best practice. And kind of importantly for us, because we were getting a little bit of business through this area, as Ori, was it didn't describe authorship dispute resolution. How would you solve issues? It's actually kind of helpful. So this is where we were starting from. We also looked at what the other policy documents that had influenced the Code of Conduct for Research. We looked at these other documents to see what they were saying about authorship. So we did a large sort of climate scan. Who's heard of this Vancouver Protocol, the ICMJ guidelines? Anyone? Yeah. These recommend the authorship is based. These now recommend that authorship is based around four criteria. It used to be just the first three. But the criteria are substantial contributions to the conception or design of the work, the acquisition, analysis, or interpretation of data for the work, and drafting the work or revising it critically for important intellectual content. And a final approval for the version to be published. And recently, an agreement to be accountable for all aspects of the work in ensuring that questions related to the accuracy or integrity of any part of the work are appropriately investigated and resolved. So these guidelines have been hugely influential.
So it's strictly and, not all.
No, that's right. You have to do everything here. Yeah. So in amongst these are problems, we think. Student researchers, in looking at four, and the intention of four, the last one, is that people have to be accountable and should assist and, you know, be responsible in solving issues that might come up with regard to the integrity of the work. It's poorly written to describe that, because it's very tough for people outside of administration to be accountable for that sort of thing to happen, especially for student researchers, students. It's very difficult to ensure that. You can agree to it, but it might be meaningless. The third point is actually quite an administrative one, but Jenny, it's something that you touched on before. Sort of saying that you've got to agree. Authors have to talk about it and say, oh, by the way, you're on this paper. Do you agree to this final version? But it is administrative, it's not necessarily about authorship. We'll look at that one and two in a bit more detail now. So these have been widely influential. So they're used by lots and lots of journals, and they've influenced codes of conduct for research published by, Australia, for example. But they're not used by many publishers, including Nature, Science, PNAS, so very well respected. And they do not work when used by certain journals, and so we've got data around that. We've used PLOS One as our main evidence base for looking at the ICMJE and their utility and how good they are, because it's what PLOS One says authorship is about. Those contributions to the conception and design of the work, acquisition of data, analysis, interpretation of data, and drafting the article, revising it critically for important intellectual content, and final approval. it's handy looking at PLOS ONE, because PLOS ONE is a very multi-discipline journal. It accepts all different types of work. It's very, very new. It's very hip. You know, they've themselves been influential in changing the landscape of publishing and how research should be communicated. It's also important because PLOS ONE say that they follow this criteria, as well as provide every article has a contribution statement at the end of it. So the authors have to say who did what. This is an example, one article. Not to pick on that article, but at the bottom of it, it says, you know, for the contributions of all the authors that are listed. And you look at it, and you try and match it to the criteria for authorship, there should only be two authors on this paper, according to the authorship criteria. Possibly none, because it doesn't say anything about final approval, but let's forget about that administrative step for a second. RGM provided very little according to the criteria, but obviously according to these authors, provided something that was important enough to warrant authorship. So if you look at more and more articles, you go through PLOS ONE, and I don't know why we stopped at 99, there should have been 100, I think we missed one. So this work is ongoing. But you don't really need to look at that many to find out that the ICMJ criteria just don't work for a PLOS ONE. Only 26% of articles actually fit the criteria, according to the contribution statements. So that's showing in the red how many authors there are, and in the blue how many authors there should be, according to the ICMJ criteria. There's discrepancies. It's been very influential, the ICMJ, and you can see its influence in the Australian Code for the Responsible Conduct of Research, which we sign up to and say we follow. Unfortunately, the description of authorship in the code is good and bad. The very front end of it, the very start of it, is right on the money. It's very good. It says authorship only where the individual has made a substantial contribution and is able to take responsibility for it. But then down the bottom here, it talks about, again, this combination of conception and design, analysis and interpretation of research data, and drafting. And the Australian Code has trouble with ambiguity here, because when they said combination, they didn't provide and or an or. So some institutions in Australia have interpreted that as an and. And then another institution got legal advice to say that it was an or. I think that's right. So thanks very much for your help. But again, if you look at this in the ICMJ criteria, you could have zero authors on a paper.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Which is often the role of the research assistant.
Yep. Yep.
Who often, as we know your experience, is often not very informed about what constitutes authorship, like the data acquisition aspect is a big issue.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you.
Because people can spend a huge amount of time, but they've only done data acquisition.
Yep. Massive problem with it as well. Yeah. Thank you for pointing that out. Pardon me. There's another document that's very, very handy, and it's sort of a beautiful piece of policy making. It's it's research integrity on a page. It's an A4 sheet of page. It's called the Singapore Statement. And just highlights the four principles that should inform all research conduct. And then says just a very, very short, brief responsibility statement about authorship, as well as other aspects of doing research. And it's just around... The problem with it is that it doesn't go into a lot of detail. So you have to work it out yourselves. But, you know, largely people do that anyway. So we wanted to get our policy wanted to be a combination, and was definitely going to be based in starting with the principles. Because if you get the principles right, everything else flows from there, and you can't go wrong. You can go wrong. If you get the principles right, you can't go wrong with the principles. You know what I mean. It's the CODRAL. That part was the quadrille. So what did we do? As I've shown you, we got a lot of evidence for a rationale for A, doing it in the first place, and where do we go with it? And that working group was instrumental in actually making this happen. And their real, at the very first meeting, they were asked, what are the principles of authorship? And they discussed it, and out of the discussion was generosity. And this is, we'd rather talk about this as an inclusive thing rather than an exclusive thing. And there is just some highlights for how you actually do consultation and things like that. We even use Twitter. There you go. And there was some important redrafting after consultation, and notably from collaborators external from the university, so people who had authored with researchers at the university. It looks like this. It is related to the code at the high level, but we're rewriting that, and it's made up of a policy as well as two procedures and guidelines that we're developing with faculties and schools. And we've only developed one guideline so far. Really, really like to start working more with the faculties and schools on those. As you go down the framework, you get more and more instruction on how to do stuff. But we wanted people, if you go to the policy, you could probably do it from there. That's what we wanted. They're all based on principles, and policies and procedures are mandatory. BIPA's, I don't know if you've heard about the Business Improvement Program. yeah, some of us have, yeah, unfortunately. This framework might change slightly, but the content will not. And they will still be mandatory. The scope of our authorship policy framework are all researchers at university, and they include all research outputs, excluding patents, although you could use the principles for inventorship. But patents are affected by law, so we couldn't include those. And increasingly for us, it doesn't include grants. Grantsmanship is different to authorship. It's very difficult for us as a responsible conduct of research thing to talk about grantsmanship. We're trying to work out the right language. The principles are these: honest reflection of contribution, assigned fairly and consistently, communicated clearly and transparently, generosity while remaining true to the requirements. So if you do those, you'll do authorship well. I started with that first dot point at the front, and that's because that's what we wrote, and that's what we worked out. Authorship is about significant intellectual or scholarly contribution and a willingness to be responsible for the contribution, your contribution. And researchers qualify as authors as long as they've made a significant intellectual scholarly contribution through at least one of these things. Normally, or often, there'll be more than one. But if you do a good enough job in one of these things, and it's really crucial, you should be an author. In fact, you must be. We put acquisition of research data there. Not routine acquisition, but where there's the significant intellectual or scholarly part to the acquisition of research data. Because too often, students and research workers were being excluded. So this is part of the inclusive nature of this. But it's nothing's terribly new in that section. In fact, we might have missed a couple of things, which is an interesting consideration. There is an attribution threshold. It is built around the either willingness to be responsible or doing intellectual scholarly work. And there are some examples of you're not considered to meet the authorship criteria. Things like routine technical assistance, or just providing funding, or just getting things because it's a gift. There are responsibilities. The main ones around recording the agreement for inclusion or exclusion. They have to be kept. We're really big on the idea of contribution statements. We provide a form on how so authors can write this stuff down, but we don't expect, and we're not going to go and audit usage of the form. It's not what ORI is about. So normally the contributions that you make to the work are intrinsic to how you when you go along and do the work. So it'll be in your lab book, or it'll be in an email. All contributors. So it's built around contributorship. They have to be recognised. A corresponding author has some roles in an administrative sense. authors must agree on author order, and that's where an important aspect of the guidelines will describe author order in those, because they're convention dependent. Some traditions and some disciplines have the idea of a senior author, normally a lab head in medicine or immunology, for example. Elsewhere, that doesn't exist. And student researchers must be recognised. What's interesting is that for some disciplines where, in arts and humanities, where you're a student researcher and you go off and do work, and you author a book or a book chapter, it's very, very strange for you to include your supervisor. You would never do that. Supervisors would be called egotists and being thrown out of their disciplines for being on a book. Conversely, in immunology or biochemistry, if you ever did that without your supervisor, you'd be in a lot of trouble. So we actually wrote exclusions for students according to the convention. Sometimes you don't include your supervisor. That's okay. The authorship procedure, which is around best practice and good practice, is just about talking about it, really. But that you have to agree on authorship, and the corresponding author has a role. What we found largely is that disputes are soluble. You can work these things out. The dispute resolution procedure is based around the idea of, if you're in a dispute, try and talk to people about it. In particular, talk to what are called research integrity advisors. Seek advice and seek support. It's an academic discussion, not a legal one. And it starts with a dialogue between people. And often, when it comes, by the time they come to us, that dialogue has failed. That's okay. From there, there's a mediation which is discipline-dependent, done by a senior academic within a discipline, so that they know the rules and conventions of authorship very, very well. And if that doesn't work, it comes to us. We've resolved two disputes using this procedure, and they were both resolved at the mediation step. So it's been successful so far, N equals 2. But there's nothing new there, really. It's a pretty standard dispute resolution. There is this promise of discipline-sensitive guidelines, and there's a lot more work to do on these. And we'd like these to be useful. But they won't say anything that contradicts the policy itself. So let's talk about tools. There is a problem with authorship. These are old data now, but 10% of people self-report that they did the authorship wrong. It is an increasing thing that we see at ORI. People have authorship disputes and author complaints about being excluded, generally, on an authorship listing. So the policy and writing this stuff down and talking about it, that's the template for doing authorship well. And just to go over it again, and so that you've got the link, because these slides will be available online, here's the policy again in a nutshell. Talking early and often, agreeing on it, describing contributions, recognising the contribution of student researchers and others. That's the template for doing this stuff well. This is a tool. Use it, bring it, take it with you into discussions. Refer to it. Test it. Let us know if it's wrong. How we're doing this, we haven't worked out the guerrilla communication about authorship. It's a resource thing, really. We're doing a lot more social media, as well as just writing, putting things in the policy library, as it was called. Again, there are these group of people called research integrity advisors, and there are other people at the university that we're targeting. The research integrity advisors are an extremely useful tool about anything to do with the responsible conduct of research, including authorship. They are the best thing about the Australian Code. RIAs provide advice. That's all they do. They're very, very helpful. They're removed from your situation. Please go and speak to them about anything about research and the conduct of it, ethical nature of it. They don't resolve disputes. They'll just be able to point you in the right direction. It's interesting, authorship, when you look at authorship listings, even in related fields, the information about what people did and their responsibilities and their relationships, it's information that's embedded. And we're getting a better sense of this and a better picture of that through our systems work that Simon Porter's group had done and the university is looking at, by asking people, by doing a climate survey. But the most easiest way of doing working out who did what and who's responsible for what and what the relationships and interactions are between people are in contribution statements. Contribution statements and thinking about your contribution and working out your contribution relative to others is really important. This was recognised a long time ago, back in the 80s, when, you know, authorship, come to the realisation that authorship is not just about writing, it's made up of different contributions. And this is an interesting discussion that was captured in the context of the ICMJE, the Vancouver Protocol, which was, it was recognised that it was wrong shortly after it was written. This is extremely, we think this is an extremely useful approach. This is a tool developed by Coslin where, again, it's not groundbreaking, it's not rocket science, you just write down the contributions that you've done according to six ways to contribute that Coslin has weighted to different levels. The idea, nothing would happen without the idea. The design of it, the implementation in terms of novelty, in terms of solving a problem practically is very important. Conducting the experiment, weight is given to data analysis, especially if that uses significant expertise or intellect. And again, writing is very important. And this, what's interesting is that if you look at those six areas, they make sense. And if you think about it, the weighting probably makes sense for the discipline, but you could change the weighting. In some disciplines, some of those areas will be more important than others. This is a tool for people in a research group that have contributed to work to get together to say, these are my numbers, these are my numbers, these are my numbers. Everyone gets around the table and goes, okay, this is the number set that we have. We've quantified the contributions. And if you've got more than 10%, you're an author. And then you've quantified contributions so that you could work out author order. So in some disciplines, the person who did the most work in terms of conducting the experiment and data analysis would go up the front, and you'd possibly be with co-authors, co-first authors, maybe two first authors, maybe seven first authors on some papers. And then the senior person, the person who had the idea and probably contributed to a large amount of the writing and the design, would be at the back end. There'd be co-senior authors, again, three co-senior authors on some papers. This is how they solve these issues. Coslin's, this framework is very good. And this is, it's where authorship is headed. This is work through the Wellcome Trust and through Harvard in collaboration with Nature and the Committee on Publication Ethics, a large group, some of whom we've spoken to and have been excluded as authors of this paper. It's interesting.
Can I just talk
yep.
to you? NHMRC clients about authorship, we think in repositories, and they're saying to us that somebody who's listed down in that collaborative list should be putting the publication in the repository. They're not actually listed as an author. So, just what we already think about that, and have any thoughts on that issue, sort of people affecting the collaborators, they're not actually listed on the paper, but the NHMRC is funding what he's saying. Vote out something.
We do recognise that acknowledgements sections are increasingly important, especially talking with research infrastructure groups, people who enable research, and they're contributing it through, collaborators contributing through access to instrumentation, technical expertise. The contributorship as opposed to authorship is a good way of working that out and measuring it. Because at the moment, acknowledgement sections are hit and miss. And in our policy, we do specify that people who have contributed to the work should be acknowledged, and that in particular, people who have allowed access to instruments. Is that...?
Yeah, it is. It's sort of, I guess, in a lot of worlds, it's not recorded anywhere, so
yeah.
It goes down to
yep.
the person in the future.
That's right. This is working out a way essentially of making authorship more like the movies credits. You know, we went to VCA and MCM, we went to the Victorian College of Arts and spoke to them going, you know, very carefully going, research is really important, you guys, you know, you're working at what research means to the VCA. This is how we think you do authorship. And the guy from theatre, movie theatre, said, have you never seen a movie? you never watch the credits at the end, you see exactly who did what.
Could I just ask for you then, I still see, you know, looking at annual publication lists, that there's authors on a papers that they couldn't physically contribute to that many papers in a year, and then on the paper because they might be in the department or so forth. Do we actually care that that's there? I mean, a lot of early career researchers express their frustration that this person is on the paper because they are seen out there. Is that an issue within the university or
yeah. Yeah, hypothetically, yes. It is. I mean, you've seen it. This is not to discount, because authorship is very difficult to actually work out who should be an author.
Yes.
And so the answer is always, it depends.
Yes.
People may have contributed greatly to an idea, a concept, and the design,
yes.
And that might last for quite a long time. It shouldn't last forever. And it shouldn't be because they're ahead of the department. So it's got to be to do with their intellectual or scholarly contribution. Some people argue that they have done that. You can see the arguments for that. The standard that you set is the standard that you walk by. This is the challenge in authorship, especially for early career researchers, even people just going, well, this is not right. For the first time ever, the university's had an independent office for people to bring complaints to. Maybe that will help. But our authorship policy is more inclusive than most others. So people have been breaking the rules for a long time, if that's the case. So we got the question about, what if your numbers of authors drop because of your policy? Well, it's either we've got it wrong, but I doubt it will happen because our authorship policy is quite generous.
I'd like to suggest you're using the word rule. Convention. But rule and regulation and law, they're all sort of ideas as to how society should run. Publishing, authorship, is about how stuff should happen or may happen within the publishing world.
Yeah. I use the term rule because we've set them. There are rules.
You have formalised a statement.
Yeah.
It doesn't become a rule.
No, not until the... Yeah, this is a part of the culture building. This is an important step. Clear expectations around cultures. This is where authorship is headed. And, sorry Paul, but your publication recording is going to get more complex. This group is building a taxonomy of how people contribute to pub research. Again, it's not new, but it's becoming formalised, and people can add essentially three amounts. You know, in computation I did, I do a little bit of it. They get a plus one to three. This is the development of... This is, I think, where the large publishers, influential publishers, want to go to.
Should we be bothered about the big publishers? They're concerned about making profit. They're concerned about livelihood that way. It's not about honesty, which is what underlies the university.
Yeah, that's right. This is, yeah, that's an interesting take on it. The taxonomy, and again, like the Costlin approach, is about people being honest in a group because they write down and quantify what they think. It's a very brutal honesty sometimes because you will write down that you think you've got 100 points on something and everyone else will not agree with that. So that's one of the major challenges of it, talking about authorship. We expect people to talk about it. We encourage you to talk about it early and often, but it's very difficult to not appear like a mercenary. Oh, really? We're going to do work together? Who's going to be first author? It's like, whoa, wait a second. Maybe we should get some data first. But some people, very well-respected people, once they write the grant and they get funding for it,